This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KKD Iowa News. Public Radio News.
Local stories of national significance. It's still wildfire season on the West Coast, and as crews work hard to put out the flames, save lives, and protect communities from damage, a conversation is raging about how it got so bad in the first place. First, there's climate change, right? That's a definite contributor. But there's also the role of forest management and whether it could have been done better. The original experts on this topic, the Native American tribes, who have occupied the West Coast for thousands of years while carefully managing the land to keep wildfire risk low. Reporter Ezra David Romero from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento reported last week on how colonization, racism, and a fire suppression mentality all reduced the ability of the tribes to manage their ancestral lands and what could change.
As a four-year-old, Bill Tripp's great-grandmother taught him how to burn land on purpose. Those cultural burns are a way of keeping wildfire in check.
Walked up the hill to a walker and handed me a box of stick matches and told me to burn a line from this point to that point.
Now as deputy director of the Karuk Tribe's Natural Resources Department at the northern tip of California, he's working to give indigenous people more power to practice cultural burns. Tripp is doing this work because Native American people were largely removed from the landscape in the mid-19th century. That altered California, said Char Miller, an environmental analysis professor at Pomona College.
Once the state of California enacted what we can call a genocidal attack upon Native peoples in the state, what started to happen was that the lands that they had tended, managed, started to do what nature does, which is to grow.
Miller says the systematic anti-Indigenous racism resulted in the exclusion of fire. Ron Good is a tribal chairman of the North Fork Mono.
Well, removal of Native American from the land is a result of what we have today.
Good says there's some hope. He's working with agencies in the Central Sierra to increase cultural burns and to restore mountain meadows. But how scalable are indigenous practices? Don Hankins, a Plains Miwok fire expert at Chico State, says vary.
It's definitely scalable on the larger public lands that are out there. You know, I'll develop maps to think about how I would go about burning in those particular places.
But Hankins admits for change to come, Californians need to adapt to the idea that fires aren't always bad. Ezra David Romero, CAP Radio News.
Ezra David Romero joins us now. Welcome back, Ezra.
Thanks for having me.
How did this story come to your attention as a reporter?
I'd been reporting on wildfire for about 8 years, and I had reported some stories like this in the past. But then I was deep in a story about fire suppression, and I was on the phone with a friend, and he was like, you need to look at racism fueling today's wildfires. And a real little red light went off in my mind. And I was like, this is a huge story. For me, it crossed over when I was talking to some of the people we'll hear later. But there was these big fires in 1910. After that, the Forest Service and others decided that wildfire is not good on the landscape. But they alerted to me that before that 1910 time, Native American people were murdered and put into camps or, you know, put onto reservations, and that their lives were taken off of the land that they've lived on for a millennia. And then, too, they have this knowledge about wildfire that was no longer there and that was sort of deemed not good. And 100, 120 years later, the absence of that historic knowledge of wildfire on the land is gone. And they say that it's resulted in this fire suppression and the ability for fires to get so big so fast. When we say fire suppression, we're just talking about putting fires out fast and then seeing a lot of brush, debris, and trees that would historically burn every 9 or 10 years not happening anymore.
Let's talk about where this story about indigenous land stewardship falls in the conversation about this record 2020 wildfire season. Has the story gotten a lot of attention?
Yeah, the story has gotten a lot of attention from outlets across the country to other people who study wildfire in California. I've seen a lot of stories in the past about returning to Native American ways in the landscape and how that is the way, but I hadn't seen many stories that question if that's actually possible or not in our current landscape. I try to capture that in this story about whether it's actually possible to go back to Native American ways. And the answer is yes, in part, as much as we can.
And that's a good segue, because that's what we're going to be talking about. I want to bring in two more guests. You heard them earlier in Ezra's story. Bill Tripp, Director of Natural Resources and Environmental Policy for the Karuk Nation. Dr. Don Hankins, Professor of Geography and Planning at Cal State University Chico. He's also a Plains Miwok cultural practitioner. Bill, as we heard, you've been setting prescribed burns since what? You were 4 years old?
Yeah, I mean, the fire I experienced at 4 years old was basically a teaching tool where I lay on my belly and try to get the black oak leaves to burn. And so I had to learn how to arrange the fuels in a way that they would burn and how I could use the fire to draw itself together to move around. And so I was able to learn how to understand what fire is and how it moves on the landscape at a very, very early age.
What makes these burns good then for preventing worse fires?
Well, you take a black oak stand, for example, you know, those leaves fall off every year. And so if you let them pile up, that's more fuel for the fire when the fire does come. So if you're able to get in there and say there's some hazel that our people need to weave baskets with, you burn it on a regular interval. Not only do you get good, healthy, pliable hazel sticks for basket weaving, but you also reduce that fuel load. So if a wildfire does come through, it doesn't burn as hot or as fast.
How does a cultural burn differ from what we might call controlled burns done by, let's say, wildlife agencies?
Well, today, people go out there with fire engines and hand tools and cut hand lines and false snags and do all these things before they do a prescribed fire. You know, they require you to have certain qualifications before you can do a prescribed fire. You know, the cultural burning I do, in a lot of cases, doesn't even involve a hand line. Sometimes it doesn't even involve having any water. It's just knowing that time of day to where a certain type of vegetation will burn. And it's going to go out when it hits that other kind of vegetation that's right next to it. It just takes a basic understanding of your environment. And you know, the longer you can interact with the same environment, the greater your understanding can be. Even prescribed burns can have cultural objectives. You know, we can use the hand tools and the fire trucks and all of these fancy toys we have today to do prescribed burns with cultural objectives as well. So we can get to the point to where we have a restored landscape to make it part of the culture once again.
Don Hankins, as someone who is both a researcher and a cultural practitioner as well, how do you describe the value of these burns and how are they different?
When I think about the situation of, you know, prescribed burning versus that cultural or traditional side of it, there's a lot of nuance that's there. As Bill alluded to, you have to have an understanding of the environment, the wind, the soil, you know, the different weather patterns that are coming in, how those are changing, what the fuel moisture conditions are in the vegetation communities you're working in. You don't have bare mineral soil being exposed by raking a line around it or anything. You know the system, you know where the fire is naturally going to go, and you work within that landscape by reading those cues. So while a lot of prescribed burns might focus in on hazard fuel reduction and wildlife habitat improvement, the timing of when that's happening, the outcomes of those fires will be quite different than what we would necessarily see from traditional burning. I've done burns with agency folks who will set the time, go out and burn, and based on cultural indicators, I know that it's not the right time. We're not in the right place for those things to take place. And I think about how that can have an adverse impact on biodiversity. So, you know, there's a lot of very specific objectives around why and when and how we're burning across different ecosystems. And every ecosystem has its specific time for when it should burn or when it's appropriate to burn within that system that is set forth based on our knowledge. And that's been passed down generation after generation.
Let me ask both of you, Don, Bill, is there a short explanation for what is a good place or when is a good time to do some of these burns?
During the onset of the rainy season is really a go-to time for burning. And I can say from my experience in working in Northern Australia, the same pattern is there. You know, when the rains start to come in, people are starting to burn or they're doing it at the beginning of the dry season is happening. And then there's a time period when there's really not any fire activity happening, but maybe just a little bit here and there. Those are the safe times to burn. And if we know our systems, it's pretty easy to be able to put fire back on the ground in those different places.
Bill, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very valid point. And there are other time frames for other things, depending on why you're burning in that cultural context. And prime example that we're seeing right now, you know, with our tan oak stands. Cutting people burn in those tan oak stands at a very specific time of year. And it's not so much because it's, you know, Tuesday, October 1st or something, but it's because the buggy acorns have fallen with that first wind that came through, or light rain. And then you get to a point to where some of the good viable acorns without bugs are starting to fall. And so there's a window of time between when that wind event happens and when those good acorns start to fall, where you typically have a range of conditions in between those weather systems that is conducive for good, safe burning. And so by watching for those cues, you're able to do that at the proper time and achieve your cultural objective to kill off the bugs before they get a chance to burrow into the ground.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday. In case you're just joining us, we're talking about the role Native Americans have had in wildfire prevention with my guests, Ezra David Romero, Bill Tripp, and Don Hankins. Ezra was reporting on the role of racism in undermining indigenous land stewardship. Bill, Don, do you experience that?
You know, I got thrown into the middle of the government-to-government consultation arena with the Forest Service when I was about 19 years old. And I'm a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, indigenous person. And so I was in meetings looking like an intern from a white family. So yeah, I heard a lot of things that would really shock a person. But when I think of the racism involved, I think of the laws that were created that made this illegal to begin with. And some of those were framed specifically around separating indigenous peoples from their resource base. The very foundations of the fire management system we have today are rooted in some of that racism.
From my experiences, I mean, obviously from a policy level standpoint, thinking back to mission time period in the state, you know, obviously the policy is a big part of that, but people hear me talk about indigenous burning and, you know, I've even had people say, well, you just want to run around naked in the woods and set fire. And it's like, no, that's not what indigenous burning is about. You know, indigenous burning is about so many levels of different thing from the cultural, the ecological, the metaphysical, you know, spiritual relationships of just being able to burn and be able to uphold that responsibility that was put to us by our ancestors. And, you know, hearing people make fun of it in that sense is hurtful. And I wish that people had a better understanding of what it is. And I know that in the past, when I have brought forward that idea of doing cultural burns and say, well, we can use it as a tool to protect, you know, the wildland urban interface and the people who live in those places, that, you know, that's one of the reasons why we do these kind of burns. That's where people's attitudes about, well, you know, the landscape has changed and people are living in these places and you can't practice the way that you used to practice. But knowing that that is our knowledge and that is what has been effective for so many thousands of years, that to me is very, very dismissive. And I hear people from within the agency say, well, we'd like to work with tribes, but they have to learn our standards to be able to do burns. Really, what I think the standard should be is the inverse of that, where if they don't have our knowledge of understanding, then they shouldn't be using fire. And when you have thousands of years of that knowledge, you don't see it in that light of fear. So those are some of the basic things that I see, you know, surfacing, and as well as just the regulations around and the policies of who can be the keeper of fire, who can actually use that tool. We have our own ways of training. We have our own ways of teaching people, and experience and intergenerational learning is a big part of that. So how do you get kids out to learn from grandma and grandpa and everybody else in the family or in the community if you're not allowed to do that because they don't have a card, or grandma and grandpa don't have a card, or they didn't pass their pack test, you know?
That's really interesting to hear that perspective. Ezra, where are you seeing meaningful pushes then toward incorporating indigenous knowledge of the land into how it's managed?
Well, there's movement across California around prescribed burns and cultural burns everywhere from Upper Billazat. There's smaller agencies that are working on it. There are other larger agencies that are doing prescribed burns, but they're not always doing it in this cultural fashion. What I learned most from reporting this story was that the decision for curbing prescribed burns or stopping them was this political decision. And so everyone I talked to said that like there needs to be a new political decision, whether it's in the California legislature or in Congress. These people who represent the people of their land need to take this up again. And one way is this National Prescribed Fire Act of 2020, and that would establish around $300 million for both the Forest Service and the Department of Interior to plan and prepare, conduct controlled burns on all these jurisdictions, whether it's federal, state, or private land. And it also will establish this $10 million for this collaborative program to work across these barriers. It will establish somewhat of an incentive program. Will actually pay certain jurisdictions to do prescribed burns. And that's if it ever leaves the House in Congress. But there is some movement around all of this, but it is still very slow to be adopted, like you hear from these two men.
Bill, as someone working on behalf of One Nation, and I'm talking about the CARIC, what resources or support would help you take care of the land better?
You know, the recognition of us as a sovereign indigenous nation that still occupies and utilizes our territorial land base, I believe, is the key to even getting serious in the conversation. I hear a lot of talk about, giving billions of dollars to this agency or giving billions of dollars to that agency. We can get a grant, but they're probably going to make us sign a paper waiving our sovereignty. And we really need to get to the point to where we can have the programs to do this in our places, because this is who we are. And this is what we've done for millennia.
I want to thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Ezra David Romero, reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Bill Tripp, Director of Natural Resources and Environmental Policy for the CARIC Nation. And Dr. Don Hankins, Professor of Geography and Planning, California State University, Chico, and a Plains Miwok cultural practitioner as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome.